in that hospital?
I think that's the question.
Probably.
Well, with the fact that there was no consideration for it, I don't know, but there's a question there too, how far back they can go. Maybe they could go back.
Why consideration would make a difference?
But I think it's an area that should be taken out of the realm of commercial commodities and commercial transactions. That's just my feeling on it.
Mr. Chairman, I got Bernie Kelly's letter to Friday, I believe. Frankly, I haven't had a chance to read it. And I don't like to read the letter.
You haven't put off action on it? Is that your wish? 1432, John, I think you heard that.
Mr. Chairman, I move this board to criminal law review situation.
Second. That's a better place than each session we get a new category. Table, defer, criminal law revision commission.
Motion is to defer and send it to the criminal law revision commission. Call roll.
Aye. Sussman?
Aye. Sternstein?
Aye.
Lynch?
Aye.
McKay?
Aye.
Wilson?
Aye.
No.
Oh.
I
think
you're
going to miss.
Out of Kirk and kill me. Senator Jernstead moved that House Bill 1555 be dispatched from this committee with a recommendation that it do pass.
We have the fun enough to send one to the floor this session with a do not pass recommendation.
I got one. I got a candidate.
Husband. Aye. Jerry Stitt. Aye. Lynn. Aye. Okay. Aye. I'm going to read this for you.
Mr. Chairman.
Aye.
I can now vote aye.
No, it's a little county.
If you want something else, I'll get a vote in here sometime.
Husband, did you vote?
I did.
So did I. Gary.
Didn't you ask me?
Yes.
1639, Notaries Public.
I can say these shall in person present you specific.
I vote aye on 1555.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm sure that was what you were.
Present his specimen.
Oh, I was reading to present his commission and specimens in the next subsection. Oh.
Does this have anything? No, it doesn't have anything to do with that. Scott.
I don't think so.
John, did you hear this?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to pass that. Yeah, I don't think that's where you're going to do it anyway.
Filed with the county clerk. The pitch they made wasn't too persuasive, but I just assumed file mine with the county clerk was the secretary of state. Is that it?
Yeah.
You think when you get a new attorney general and you start collecting those 50 cents worth of fees and throwing them surprisingly up?
Yeah. Call roll.
Burns.
Aye.
Husband.
Aye.
Jernstead.
Aye.
Lent.
Aye.
McKay.
No.
Willer.
Aye.
Mr. Chair.
You have to file in the county clerk down county. But this permits you to file it in another county. Other than Lane County, for instance.
Statewide.
You can file it
in
many
counties. Oh, that means he has to go
right away. Nothing wrong the way it is now.
Yeah. There isn't it.
I don't think so.
1838.
Well, if you want to reconsider the vote, I'll vote no.
No, I think, Mr. Chairman, the evidence that came before us was that sometimes a county clerk is asked to certify that husband is a notary public. And if this, and if I happen to take an acknowledgement in Douglas County, that county clerk couldn't...
Well, that's all right then.
Sounds like the rest of the Secretary of State bills was passing.
1838.
All right.
This one needs some amendments.
Chairman, I wrote some circuit judges about this bill, and I think it's generally a good bill. One suggestion that I have for an amendment from Bob Jones, Crookham, and Jim Burns is on line 15 of page 2, that the $5,000 fine would equally apply to county jail and penitentiary sentences.
How do you?
Well, so then that after 10 years, delete the period, and you say,
line 15, after 10 years, delete the period,
you say, or by a fine of not more than $5,000 or both. And I have a letter here in which the judge is saying that when you get involved in really hardcore pusher type, the fine is oftentimes most useful, since some of those worst offenders are those who, in my judgment, need to get hit and have a fine as well as a lengthy term.
Well, the way it sits, you can only fine the little guy, not the big guy.
Yeah, the only way, the way it sits in the bill, you can only fine the people in the county jail, but not the people in the pen.
Did you all hear the amendment? On line 15 of the bill, delete the period and place, or by fine if not more than $5,000 or both.
Do the same thing, John, on page 3, line 7.
Yeah. After what, Chairman?
After the period. Delete the period on line 15 and insert, or by a fine of not more than $5,000 or both.
This was the bill I thought we were going to get that
She's over here. She's here. Right here.
I don't think she wanted John Wilson thinks he hurts his cause.
Yes, he does.
I tend to agree.
I do too.
Some of the judges now are arbitrarily reducing these possession cases to frequenting the place where drugs are dispensed so they can get the kids under the misdemeanor part. The other thing, Mr. Chairman,
one more. Same amendment on line 17, page 3.
What was the amount of the fine? 5,000 or 500?
5,000. You've written that down twice.
Well, I know, but...
But only for a part. Did you have another thing?
Well, the only question that I had, and Judge Bob Jones, I thought, and Judge Charlie Crookham made a pretty good case for this, and that is that we should standardize the penalties between marijuana and the dangerous drugs. The amphetamines, the speeds, the barbiturates, which presently are misdemeanors, but really, as Dr. Gaber indicated, are more dangerous than marijuana, that they should carry the same. You see, presently, marijuana is a felony.
But this bill doesn't do that?
Well, I'm not sure that it does, Don. I want to make sure that it does, and I wanted to have a chance to look at it. And I'm sure that. So that. We'd have an optional felony misdemeanor for possession of marijuana or for possession of dangerous drugs. Because possession of dangerous drugs now, some of it is only a 90-day sentence.
All right, what we'll do, you've heard the amendments, plus adding the emergency clause. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Carried. Now, Senator Burns, would you between now and Thursday study this and report to us on whether it gives us the insecticides you're talking about.
Can I ask a question? to raise another
thank
question.
Thank you very much.
To raise another question, well, the chairman of the Rules Committee is here. I got a request from the Willow County Commissioners a long time ago to introduce a certain bill.
Commission. And you couldn't come on the day that we postponed the hearing, so we're here today. And who knows if you come forward, state your name, occupation, address, and tell us what matter you're connected to the bill.
Can I sit here?
Yes.
I'm Gene Rhodes. I'm a member of the law firm, Material Keith Rhodes and Rudd, and I'm Terry Warren.
What a guy.
Just recently. Can't be held against them for too long. I'm also a member and have been for about 3 or 4 years of the State Public Law Foundation.
That's what I meant.
And I shan't be for much longer. I want to address a few remarks on behalf of the State Public Welfare Commission about Senate Bill 300. First, let me say this. As a lawyer, the APA appeals to me legally. First, it's a uniformity that proposes for dealing with administrative agencies, and certainly it's for the manner in which it proposes to safeguard legal rights. So I'm interested in this, but I'd like to just call this committee's attention, Mr. Chairman, to some of the things that the State Public Welfare Commission is concerned about in this bill. Our concern is really in two essential areas. First, administratively, what effect is it going to have on the State Public Welfare Commission? And secondly, financially, what effect is it going to have? Now, this bill provides for two areas, really, the rulemaking and the order-making procedures, something that we deem completely different than has existed before at the welfare level. It provides that before any rule can be adopted, that we have to go through certain formalities. We have to give notice, not less than 20 days, publish it to the Secretary of State's bulletin. We have to notify what the context of the rule, the change, and these type of things. The normal thing that we're familiar with as lawyers, I'm sure. But a rule is defined rather broadly in the definition. It means any agency directive, regulation, or statement of general applicability that implements, interprets, or prescribes law or policy. Now, let me give you a couple of examples of things that bothered us in the State Public Welfare Commission. In late February this year, we staff ascertained that there was a surplus existing. The question was what to do with the surplus. After two or three meetings, we decided that the proper thing to do, since standards hadn't been increased since the early 1950s, was to increase standards by raising the shelter allowances, I call them, and other allowances. Now, this required a rule change. Now, we had to act rather quickly on this. So, we just put this into effect as of April 1st. Now, if we had to comply with this act administratively, then we would have had to publish notice, we would have had to provide for a public hearing, and do these things. Suppose the corollary of this were true. Suppose that in lieu of a surplus, we found we were operating with a deficit, which with the new jurisdictional requirements the Supreme Court just passed on, we might very well be very quickly. This could have happened if that Supreme Court decision was passed, let's say, last November, and then we had to start giving everybody assistance regardless of the residence requirement. As I understand the law, we're obligated to operate within the amount of money that the legislature provides for us. So we would have had to do the corollary and reduce standards, which we are doing all the time. And then we would have had to go through this rulemaking procedure that's provided in the APA, publish notice, and have a hearing. Now, these things get rather hot and contested. We were besieged with attorneys provided by the federal government in Portland telling us that we shouldn't apply this money in the manner in which we decided to apply it by increasing shelter allowances. We should give them a bonus right straight across the board. We should determine how much it was and put a percentage in and do that. We had all kinds of suggestions we made. So the point I endeavor to make here is that this hearing was in my opinion, would have led to a tremendous amount of discussion and a lot of opposition as to what should have been done with this money. By the time we would have resolve the question, the biennium would have been passed and the recipients wouldn't have gotten the money. It was good or bad. Another example of where we have to act rather rapidly is, you know, on November 18th, we were notified by the Department of Health, Education, Welfare that they were changing their definition of what an unemployed parent was, reducing the hours. They gave us until January 1st, 1969 to make this change, make a statement from the federal. We had to go through the rulemaking procedure. I seriously doubt that we could have gotten this done. We would have lost, in essence, federal funds. Now,
I realize probably I should wait till it's done, but you have stated you have a rule, and since it is a rule, you have to have a follow your procedure for changing rules in order to have it. But the instances you've given might not have had to be rules in the first place. I'm not positive about that.
Well, we interpret, Senator, we interpret this act that that would be a definition of a rule.
The amount of money that would be paid for shelter would be a rule.
Yes, we think that this would be a rule. Fall within the definition of one, that you would have to comply with providing some form of a public hearing under this statute.
Well, if you were to decrease it, I think that might be possible. What person has a right to contest the increase?
Well, it might not be Senator's right to increase, but it would, the arguments that we have presented to us were these, that you're increasing it in the wrong area, that you should do it across the board.
Nobody had a legal right to spend that money some other way. That's enough. I'm sorry.
Now, the point I'm trying to make is that we average 35 rule changes a year in the State Public Welfare Commission. Now, we do these by categories. For example, in drugs, pharmaceutical rates, and medical revision guides, things like this. And there might be anywhere from 1 to 50 categories in every rule change that we have. We're a little bothered, practically, about what the effect of this act would have on welfare. I keep going back to this. Legally, I like the bill, but practically, as it applies to welfare, it scares us a little bit. There is a provision in the act that provides for an emergency. We could declare an emergency. But this bothers us also because, first, what is an emergency? I seriously doubt they would permit us, there's judicial review provided here, says that I suppose that we are having an increase in rates or we're going to provide more. Is this an emergency? Can we declare an emergency in the vote? Even if we do this under the bill, well, we would still have to have the public hearings. It can only be in existence for 120 days. Then we're going to have to go through the hearings. Suppose on the opposite is true, that we're reducing. Can we declare an emergency? I would think there we can, but then we're going to have a hearing to have the public tell us to do what we're obligated by law to do, get yourself within the budgetary amount that's allowed to. So we're a little bit alarmed about the rulemaking procedure in this bill. It also gives the right to any interested person to question, petition the agency regarding any rule that we adopt, the amendment of anything to do with that rule. Well, we're trying to live within the funds all the time. Everyone has a different view on how we should spend these monies. The nursing home people are there 1 month. The hospital people are there 1 month. Now, what this portion of the bill does, it seems to us, is just formalize judicial review. They'll petition us to say that we should. The nursing home rate that you have prescribed based on audits is erroneous. Off we go in judicial review on that. Now, the second part of the bill is about the order-making process. By its definition, contested case, and by its definition of an order, it seems to me like almost everything we do over there in the way of making grants, denials, and making modifications, reductions, would fit into the category of order making. We in 1968 in public assistance alone had 8,100 denials, 700 non-approvals, 29,000 case closings, and then issued at 100,000 grant reductions and 5,000 vendor payments, plus relative responsibility, plus foster home certification, plus the question of what rights the foster parents had. These are all potential rights of appeal cases. Now, under the act as it was submitted to you, as I understand, these would be matters in which we would have to go through an order-making process by serving a notice of a proposed order upon the person involved, giving that person the right to present evidence to the commission assembled as a group to appeal the ruling, do all these things. Secondly, it also gives, it converts really, the system into an adversary proceeding, as it provides, as I'm sure you're aware, from equity rules of prevail. We're talking about deposition, prima facie cases, and these things. So it bothers us in two realms. Really. First, it does convert to an adversary system, which is not bad ipso facto, but I think the State Public Welfare Commission is now going to have to staff it, or have its people who are hearing the fair hearings, who are hearing relevant responsibility, be lawyers, because I can't conceive that a person could hear cases under this statute unless they're legally trained. Secondly, I think it would sound the death knell of the State Public Welfare Commission, as we now know the members are. Each month, we review about 40 relevant responsibility cases that are submitted to us before we come down. We review, I would suppose, 15 fair hearing summaries. Every category of assistance, with the exception of general assistance, I think, is provided the right under statute for a fair hearing if they don't like what we've done. I think we do that administratively, if we can give them a fair hearing there. We review these. Now, as we understand this, if anybody asks for a fair hearing, we have to provide, we have to comply with the APA there. These people will then have a right to have this order submitted to them. They can appear in front of us at a commission meeting and argue this thing as to whether the proposed order is correct or incorrect. Now, the law firm that I'm presently with, I think is, well, I know it's a little bit unreasonable to expect me to give more time to my law practice than I do to the State Public Welfare Commission. And if out of the 65 to 75 cases that we review each month, even 10% of these would appear before us and we had to hear these as a reviewing body, then it seems to me like that's the death knell of the commission form of the government. It's like the order might be bad. I think it's particularly bad for a man like Dr. Kaiser, who is the chairman of the commission, because I think he's done a splendid job in the welfare commission, particularly in his relation with physicians, who are one of the areas of the most controversial existence since I've been there. And I would hate to see a situation exist where a man like Dr. Kaiser would be compelled to leave a commission because he might be spending 2 or 3 days a month in reviewing these types of hearings. Now, the point is that I think what you really get down to is this an area, is this a ball game where we really need this type of a thing? And I think that's a philosophical question. Financially, the second end of this thing is financially. I don't think the State Public Welfare Commission, we don't have anything in the budget anticipating this type of a procedure applying to the State Public Welfare Commission.
As I understand it now, there is no opportunity for a hearing before the commission in the event that they are agreed under the existing procedure.
Yes, there is. Senator, we have under the statutes, under every category, as I understand it, with the exception of general assistance, they have a right to request a fair hearing. It's heard before a hearings officer. And the hearings officer makes a recommendation, they can come before the commission if they desire. Of recent ones, they have been appeared. Some of them had one last month.
This doesn't really change that.
Well, I think it changes it to this extent. That if, under this provision here now, I'm looking at page 13, line 24. When in a contested case, the majority of the officials of the agency who are to render the final order have not heard the case, which we do not hear, or have not considered the record, which we don't consider the record as such, the order, if adverse and wrong, shall not be made until a proposed order, including findings of fact and conclusions of law, have been served upon the parties and an opportunity has been afforded to each party adversely affected without exception, and present argument to the officials who are to render the decision, who shall in such case personally consider the whole record, such portions of it as may be cited. I think under this we would have to have a proposed order prepared, serve it on the people, then they could appear in front of the commission and present formal arguments. Now, since this initial bill was presented, I have been in touch with a member of the Oregon State Bar who have proposed an amendment to this, proposed an amendment to the bill, wherein, as I understand it, they will exclude all the cases where we are reducing grants, increasing grants, things like this, unless they do request the right of a fair hearing. That would be the exception. This is a step in the right direction. This really helps immensely. The only problem there is that if they request a fair hearing, then we're going to have to go through this same procedure that we're talking about here, the proposed order being inserted. Relative responsibility has not been excluded under their amendment. We're going to have that. The nice question is, suppose a foster home case, suppose we have a foster parent saying that I have a right to keep these children in my home. This is a right or a privilege within the meaning of that statute. Are they entitled to a hearing under the statute? We don't know. We don't know. The second thing I'd like to point out is financially, we're not too good for this thing. We're going to have additional publication costs, the rulemaking process, additional costs in hiring the people I think who are legally trained to handle all of these hearings. More important, in the government's recommended budget, 90% approximately $90 million comes into federal funds. I don't think they have proposed another amendment to this act, which I think will pretty much eliminate the error or the danger of us losing our federal funds. But we could, in isolated instances, for example, in the illustration that I pointed out at first, we have a case where the federal people say to us, change your meaning of an unemployed parent to conform with ours. We can't get the rulemaking process through fast enough. We could conceivably lose federal funds there. The part about their amendment that we're concerned with is that we've got to get a ruling out of a federal official saying that our act is not conforming with theirs. And this bothers me a little bit because it's been slow as molasses for me to get a federal official to rule on anything. We route them through San Francisco in the welfare department, and then they go to Washington, D.C. And we have to get a ruling that our state provisions are not in conformity or can jeopardize federal funds from a federal officer. It might be 2 to 3 months later before we get that. In the meantime, we've lost the federal funding. So this bothers us. Like I say, practically, and the bill bothers me for the safety.
How much longer would it take under this bill than it does under the existing procedures you described earlier?
On rulemaking, we just meet. Like when we found this surplus, Mr. Juris called us down. We met at his house and visited about the thing a little bit, and went into session the next morning and talked about it for about 2 hours and put it into effect as of right then. How much longer was it? How much do we have? Is it 30 million?
The amount we drew on there was about 900,000.
Was there any notice of that meeting so the interested persons could come and talk about how to spend the money?
Well, people knew. People knew, that's right. That this had come up because there were a lot of people there at that time. No. No, at the meeting the following morning, we put it on the agenda for the following morning.
In your earlier testimony, I was trying to say you simply preferred your own red tape to the red tape that's in this, but it sounds like you were actually operating with less red tape.
We operate with less red tape. I think that's right, and that's why I think this is the question. Is it really necessary in this type of situation to provide the APA safeguards to people who are receiving welfare assistance that should be built in this type of area? I think this is a philosophical question. I don't really think so. I think there are safeguards provided right in the act now. Because we do those requirements. We do that.
Well, that's why I was asking about those fair hearings. Good argument. As far as that part is concerned, the individual right is concerned, you said they could argue it, but they wouldn't have any chance to know in advance what the conclusion might be to make legal objections to the conclusion before it was entered.
Well, I think it's a little different than that, Senator. I think this bill presupposes that we're going to have an adversary system. Now let's suppose that we have a man who's taking or is getting welfare, and the caseworker determines that he has a savings account that doesn't permit him to be on welfare, so he notifies him, and we take him on welfare. He asks for a fair hearing. Now, under our procedure, he can have a fair hearing. He goes in front of the hearings referee, and it's a rather informal proceeding. They're not bound by any rules of evidence. And they go through all this thing, and he can bring anybody he wants, present anything he wants, and then the hearings officer prepares a recommended report to the commission members. They're submitted to us prior to our regular monthly meeting, and we determine whether the staff member acted or whether this hearings officer acted properly or not. We have reversed several of these since I've been in the commission. But this formalizes even more, because now we have an adversary proceeding where I think you're going to have a hearings officer who is legally trained. Because how in the world can he determine whether a prima facie case has been made before an order of default, unless he's a lawyer, unless he's legally trained? How can he tell what the rules of equity are, or whether you can take it under the rule of these things, unless he's a lawyer? Now, the one point I'm trying to make is that if we pass this bill, and the welfare is under us, you need to be, then you have created, I think, a very practical problem for welfare people handling these cases, and a very difficult financial problem right now. I'm not saying that this bill isn't good, and it isn't probably the kind of thing that we ought to have, because any attorney that's dealt in front of the administrative agencies bothers me. But it bothers me here as an individual member of the commission.
Any further questions, Mr. Rose? Not thank you very much. Now, I noticed that also signed up again is Mr. Hamill and Mr. King. I beg your pardon. Before we go into that, we have one little matter we want to take care of. What was the number? 1404. Please turn to that.
Today's agenda.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I might briefly explain about this. Some information I gave to the House Committee on Labor and Management. I'm not sure that the bill is necessary, and I asked them to check with Mr. Lafferty to see if he thought they could do this already. Apparently, they decided that they couldn't. Here's the thing. If this is a two-edged sword, this change. All it does is make sure that I might have a hearing before hearing officer. There are several issues involved, and he'll say that he makes a decision that one party is willing to live with all together. The other party on the 30th day files an appeal and requests, we'll say, only review certain things. Now, I don't know whether if that happens, the board has authority then to review the whole matter or not. It's not clear to me, it's not clear. All this bill does says this, that if one party files, then the other party has at least 10 days to file a cross appeal to the board. And it can work either way, four claimants or four carriers. There's no joke in it, but I know
the cross appeal would not be limited to the matters raised by.
The cross appeal could raise the other matters and could request a complete review of the matter.
I thought that was the law.
Well, I became convinced that although the broad review language, maybe a party could restrict. File on the 30th day, the other party was going to live with the order as a whole, but also had some reservations about a couple of. All this does is say, well, you appeal, I've got 10 more days to appeal. And that's the explanation I have for it. They heard me twice, which is twice I went over there to say just what I said. Now, I told you to take 3 or 4 minutes.
Any questions, Senator Lane? Do you want to take action on it?
Oh, I don't care whether you want to take action.
We'll just get it done.
Just get it done.
Take the motion.
I move to present 1404 to the board to pass.
The discussion? Call the roll.
Fagan?
Aye.
Preston?
Aye.
Jernigan?
Aye.
Lynn?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Maybe they controlled my vote.
I'm going to have an excuse for that.
Yeah. I was trying to figure out who did.
So we turn to 300, Mr. Hamill. I beg your pardon,
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Henry Kane, KNE 2855 Northwest Arcadia, Fort Beach, Oregon. I'm Assistant Attorney General, but I emphasize. emphasize that I appear here solely as a member of the State Bar Committee of Administrative Law, and my remarks are not to be construed as reflecting the views of the Attorney General or the Attorney General designee. I am in the partner office of the Attorney General and have been for the past 6 years, and as such, I represent 17 agencies and have practiced a great deal of administrative law across the board. In fact, Judge Court ruled on an administrative appeal from the Board of Pharmacy marijuana just a few weeks or months ago. I also served as Executive Secretary of Legislative Committees on Public Welfare and Small Business, and have been a consultant on welfare to the Legislative Fiscal Committee. In the formal presentation of the bill by Mr. Hamill earlier, it was not emphasized, I believe, sufficiently that the bill reflects the views not only of the bar as a whole, but it also incorporates many of the views of the public attorneys who served on that committee. And I believe Mr. Hamill will confirm that, partly at my insistence and those of others, several provisions were inserted in the bill designed to protect the interests of the public at large. This is not a housekeeping bill designed to merely close some deficiencies in an original model statute. It is designed, as I see it, to extend procedural due process in an area where the legislature, by reason of necessity, has given the administrative agencies a great deal of discretionary authority, and much time could be devoted to citing instance after instance where, shall we say, a member of the public and his attorney in a hearing which I was on the opposite side did not have as many procedural and substantive rights as I, for one, as an individual, thought he should have. And I would conclude by saying that I take no position on the matters that are in controversy, because I don't think that would be proper because of my official position, but the general theory of the bill and those who worked on it over a period of years was to better redress the balance between the rights of the agencies of the government to conduct its activities and the rights of the public in general and individuals regulated by those agencies.
Any questions, Mr. Kane?
The letter that I sent to the chairman was dated April the 23rd.
Don't count the pages.
And I don't know whether you had, whether you received that. I presume that you had. Since your husband, if you, you don't have a copy, I think.
Well, I probably have that.
I have an extra one.
But
this did come today.
No, that didn't. No, the letter from Mr. Nordyke came today in response to this amendment. But section 19 sub 4 is designed to permit the agency to determine that some particular provision of the APA would put them out of conformity with the federal requirements and jeopardize federal funds. As I stated at the last appearance, we don't want to cause that to happen. And the purpose of this is to permit them to so fine and thereby have the effect of making the federal law supreme and the APA yield to that extent. The question was raised as to whether this is an unconstitutional delegation of legislative power. And in my memo dated April the 23rd, I cite the authorities that we had in Oregon on this question, particularly Article 1, Section 22, which permits the legislature to delegate to a state officer the power to suspend the operation of the law. It comes as a surprise to the lawyers, but nevertheless, that's what our Supreme Court held. And that's under the section that declares that the operation of the law shall never be suspended except by the authority of the legislative assembly. It's not a delegation of legislative power now in the usual sense. This is the operation of the law. And our court has held that if you can do that, 19 sub 4 was designed to permit the very thing. In the interim, we've been in conversation with both the attorney for the Welfare Department and the Employment Department, and prepared amendments to try to satisfy them. And I think I sent a copy of this forward to each of you, but in the last day, we had some additional amendments which add one clause to the first one, and I would like to submit them to the committee at this time.
Now, these are complete, Lloyd.
These are completely complete. And I have copies for the rest of you. Now, the First Amendment has as its basic purpose to, first, as far as welfare is concerned, references. Well, first, as far as the Employment Department is concerned, references to 657 series of numbers. The Employment Department has the proceeding before the deputy, and he enters his decision. That's the preliminary decision, and in no sense can that really be considered a hearing. It's his investigation, that's his determination. He does contact the parties involved. And the effect of this proposal is to exempt that determination from the APA and to subject to the APA only the decision that is made by the referee at a public hearing under their existing law, that and subsequent proceedings. Those hearings conducted by the referee at the present time are due process hearings. Rules that are applied by their hearing officers are in no substantial way different than what the APA would require. The scope of judicial review of the Employment Department orders under the present statute is no different in substance than what the APA has codified in this bill. I made that point at the first hearing that the judicial review provisions of Senate Bill 300 are really a codification of what our Supreme Court has said. So that the references in the first, on line four, the First Amendment to 657.270 is a reference to the referee hearing, and the 657.683 is a reference to the subjectivity hearing, both of which are conducted by referees at the present time, due process hearings, which are not substantially different than what the APA would require. I just
not believe that adopting this amendment would adversely affect the employment department in any way. The next reference to the chapters 411, 412, etc. applies to the Welfare Commission. After consulting with Mr. Pinkerton and going over the many determinations that Mr. Rose has referred to here that are made by staff people as preliminary matters, the effect of this proposal is that any of those preliminary decisions made by staff people that in any way affect benefits under welfare would not be affected by this bid. It is only when the person pursues his remedy through the Welfare Commission up to the fair hearing stage under their own statute, to be either conducted before a referee or the commission itself, that the APA would apply. The fair hearing phrase comes from their statute. It is required by the federal law, and the effect of this is to make that fair hearing subject to the APA requirements. And nothing more. Again, I don't feel that from a substantive standpoint it would adversely affect the Welfare Commission one iota.
On that point, would you have to have a lawyer or hearing officers in order to comply with the APA with this bill?
No.
Would you have to have a written record in order to comply with this bill? Let's call for a record on review by this whole commission. Would it be a written record?
Yes.
Would it be verbatim?
Yes.
What do they do now?
I don't know what they do by way of a record, but they do prepare a summary of that record for the commission.
Does the federal fair hearing requirement require a verbatim record? That could be a change.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Your opinion, Lord, is the 183 procedure that you are seeking here to provide more due process, is it better? And so in what ways?
Well, with regard to the Welfare Commission, and it is better, I'd like to just react to some of the statements made by Mr. Rook. The determinations are made, and a summary of that is submitted to the Welfare Commission. He indicated they have some 46 a month. My point, I guess, would have to be this, that either that summary, their determination made by the commission, constitutes compliance with the requirements of the APA bill, which is here on line 13, section 183.460, which says that the officials who make the decision have to consider the record. Either that summary, that consideration, constitutes a consideration of the record, or it doesn't. If it does, then the commissioners are making the decision. If it does not constitute a consideration of the record, then the people are being denied what the statute says they're entitled to, and that is a decision by the commissioner. Commissioners are either making it or some reference hearing officer.
The question is, you think they get a better hearing if you are on if 183 applies? They simply can.
I think that they would get a better hearing, their rights would be protected, the rules would be known, the record would be public. And either they get a full consideration by the commissioners, not some staff, or they'd be entitled to appeal.
As I understand it, if they do not provide a full consideration by the commissioners, then they could appeal, or put that in the disjunctive.
If they don't, and if there is no record, then when the appeal goes to the circuit court, the hearing is, you know.
But if there is a record, then the only hearing on appeal would be whether there was a legal justification for the decision of the commission.
So that if the commission does not want to change their practice in any way, then the only effect of the bill is that when it, if and when it is appealed to the circuit court, it would be a hearing to know, rather than a restriction of review.
That's a pretty good sanction.
The alternative is there. But that is true at the present time, and we're due for the department and other agencies, where we don't have a record. The Second Amendment that I just handed you is a suggested alternative to Section 1974 on page 20 of the bill.
Page 18.
Objection was made to unconstitutional delegation of power to the agency to suspend the law. The effect of this is to recognize that the federal law says the Secretary of Labor, in the case of the Employment Department, and the Secretary of HEW, in the case of the Welfare Commission, have the final authority to determine whether or not a state is out of conformity. He cannot do that without a hearing, notice, opportunity to be heard. When he's made that decision, it's just not your court making the decision. The procedure is bad. The effect of this is to permit the agency, when it's found that, to then proceed under what the federal law requires, despite this last week, the decision that one-year residency is no longer good. That didn't deprive Oregon of one federal dollar, the fact that we still have that statute on the books. It doesn't deprive us one dollar, but we're out of conformity now. If we don't do something about it, we will be now. The purpose of this section is to permit federal law to be supreme, to observe the federal law, and not jeopardize those federal funds. In my memorandums dated April the 23rd, I think I've cited plenty of very recent authority to support this kind of a provision.
Mr. Hamill, you say that you've discussed, and I imagine you're referring to the Second Amendment here that Mr. King.
Yes.
Is this satisfactory with the Welfare Commission?
No, sir. Mr. Rose has just testified this afternoon, and I think he's indicated he's not satisfied yet.
Did Mr. Pinkerton indicate that this would satisfy the commission?
He refused to admit himself. But that's the matter for the commission.
With respect to the Department of Employment, are they satisfied with the
Mr. Murdoch is not satisfied with the amendment. He would be. I think he said that if we limited it, we only included in the First Amendment, I just gave you a reference to 657.683. He said he thought he could live with that, but he did not think he could live with 270. I'm not stating, if I'm not quoting correctly, I'm correct.
Is the Public Utilities Commissioner satisfied with the language containing the original bill?
We haven't received any objection from them. Mr. Bear is here.
Do you intend to testify? How about the other agencies who are now placed under the ADA?
We've been in contact with them for the last 2 years since the bill has been in the legislature. We haven't had any solid contact.
As far as you know, the only two agencies concerning whom we have any problem are the Welfare Commission and Department of Employment.
To the best of my knowledge, that's right. There's one other thing that I would like to leave with the committee. Because of my many conversations with the attorneys for the two objecting agencies, I asked Representative Wyatt if he would attempt to secure an opinion from the federal agencies involved as to whether they thought Senate Bill 300 would put Oregon out of conformity. I have copy the letter I received, special delivery just this morning, addressed to Representative Wyatt from the attorney for HEW. And I expect to get a copy of a letter to the same effect, Secretary of Labor, but I don't have it yet.
Mr. Ogilvy, Mr. Wyatt's administrative aide has indicated that it will be to the same effect, but I'm going to wait until I see it before I believe it. The effect of this letter from HEW is to say that as long as Section 19 sub 4 of the bill does what it purports to do, then he doesn't see anything wrong with Senate Bill 300.
Any further questions, Mr. Hamill?
I think really that this ought to have some influence on this thing.
As either Mr. Rose or Mr. Nordyke had not been able to see this letter.
I gave him a copy this morning as soon as I got in town.
All right, any further questions?
I have one other matter.
All right.
There are some other bills pending. One of them was Senate Bill 232, which was passed. It became Chapter 80 of Oregon Law 69, creating the Executive Department and the Personnel Division. There's House Bill 1149 that is still pending in the legislature. And I would like you to offer just an enumeration of the various amendments that would be necessary, first to accommodate the passage of Senate Bill 232, and to state the committee's position with regard to House Bill 1109, and to accomplish the amendment which was suggested by Mr. Underdahl of the Department of Finance, General Services, at our last meeting. Those would do nothing more than to incorporate into this bill what's already been done, what would be necessary to do in order to accomplish these other bills. In discussing the matter with Mr. Pinkerton and Mr. Nordyke, for the two agencies that are doing the objectives, the ability to compromise and reach solutions which are mutually acceptable to advocate to the committee, I feel under some restraint, because the bar has approved the bill. My ability to come down here and encourage the passage of the bill, I feel, is restricted by the action of the Bar Committee for the Bar Association. I think that the important thing is that the principles of the bill be passed promptly, so we get a little hope over to the House. If the committee is persuaded by the objection of these two agencies, then the amendments are necessary are your problem. I don't feel free to advocate on that, but I do urge the committee to act promptly.
You would wish to be heard in the event that they submit an amendment that was satisfactory to them, however, I would.
I'm sure that they would let me see them.
Well, Lloyd, regardless of your position with the bar, and I realize that you can't negotiate for the bar, would it be possible for you and Mr. Pinkerton and Mr. Nordyke to agree upon some amendments without your being able to endorse them as a representative of the bar that you think might be acceptable?
If this committee were to say, do this, I'm sure that we could agree in a half an hour.
Obviously the big players are seeking some reaction to what our reaction was and make a difference to what they would do. I strongly favor getting the greatest possible due process hearing in these exempted situations. I am sick and tired of federal government's here, it's not even federal, it's a local interpretation of what the federal government might do, restricting our right before a due process determines in this case. I recall one previous situation where I had to deal with MDTA two sessions ago.
vetoed by Governor Hackett on the grounds that somebody raised the question of how it compliance with federal law. Governor Hackett relied on the phone with appropriate officials, federal government, they decided that it was certainly our itinerary. I think we ought to go as far as we can to get every claimant of the state due process under our law.
Well, I think, Senator Wilner, you're right, but at the same time, I'm equally sick and tired if a satisfactory procedure exists for someone under the name of due process to say, you've got to come in and change this whole thing, when from a realistic and practical point of view, it's possible that it won't work, that it'll cost a great deal more and cause a great deal of problem. I agree with you in principle. I would suggest it's the 30th day of April, and we won't be here too much longer. If this bill is to have any chance of success, my suggestion would be that Mr. Hamill and these two attorneys get together and come to us with something that they can all live with, because then probably without too much difficulty we can get something out. And if you have success in changing it in the House, perhaps the Senate will concur, or at least it will go to a conference committee. The point is, this is going to remain here if we have to listen to one side and then the other, and I think, boy, you just have to be realistic about it. Maybe you can come as close as you can to achieving everything that you desire. I certainly would like to get something out of the committee, but I think that's probably the practical answer. At least the committee would then be in a position to look at it and say,
well, for example, the point made by Mr. Rose, that he feels that even under the emergency procedure to adopt rules, you would have to have 20 days notice. That certainly, obviously, is not the intention of this. And I'm sure that we can agree on some language that would qualify and take care of that. And they could adopt those emergency rules immediately. But I guess I would look to the committee for instructions as to what you want, what you're willing to approve by way of degree or qualification on the exemption of these two agencies that are objecting.
Well, I can't speak to the committee. Is there any objection to my suggestion to Mr. Hamill that he get together with these two people and bring something to the three of them?
Right, together with three. Yeah, I think that's a good idea, together with one other comment. It may be a question of complexity or lack of time or just simply ignorance on the part of the general public, but I have the feeling, it's not an intellectual conviction, I have the feeling that people are frequently horsed around between state law and federal law by the agencies which are able to say, oh, we'd like to do that, but we can't because of the federal law. And if those conflicts between the two governments, and in fact, that way of avoiding the issue can be minimized in their considerations, it would be helpful to me in seeing the merits of this bill. I wouldn't want it made more difficult for the average person to find out who at least is responsible for telling him no.
To give people a due process hearing in this state, let's give them.
If you want to do that, the committee will consider whatever you bring to us the first meeting after you do it.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask this often? I think they should try to do it if they can, but if we still have disagreement, could we set it down for our next hearing and let's vote on it? Maybe there is a majority that favors the Hamill amendment.
We'll set it down after Mr. Hamill brings back the suggestion.
And if they cannot agree, then that is
well. If they can't agree, the committee's going to have to make a decision.
Yes, that's all I want.
Thank you. Judge Ford, you are here on House Bill 1396, I believe. Would you two forgive us? I know you're representing Judge Hort, come all the way from Eugene. Come forward, Judge Hort.
That's all. I suspect at least one of the representatives here in the same bill I am. He was introduced by her personally. This is not, my name is Willis Ford, Circuit Judge. I appear here today as the chairman of the Legislative Committee of the Oregon Juvenile Court Judges Association, with the probation chiefs of the various counties and local judges. I'm
specifically its purpose is to make certain larger housekeeping amendments to the bill that reflect our view as to the requirements of the recent Supreme Court of the United States decision, one of the 10 cases called.
$13.96. Yeah. The tag, the tax, probably very
low. Yes, yes.
Excuse me.
No, I don't know.
Basically, the changes that are obviously set forth in this outside print, together with the amendments, but some of you also have the amendments that were approved by the House and are now in the bill as passed by the House.
We have a mark that says
that the must come to us. Then the subsection 3, line 31 of page 2 of the bill adds the requirement that a petition should be served upon, along with the summons, upon the person to receive. Our statute is silent on this. In both cases, makes it mandatory that actually a copy of this lawsuit petition be served on the child, child parent, and so forth. This is as a suggestion, but one which we think is required. And a great many courts, in fact, have been doing that, but there are some on this account. The subsection 5 on page 3 is a new addition to the statute. It simply says that this is with reference to the summons being issued and so forth. Summons has to be signed. The summons be the child of 12 years of age or older, a certified copy of the summons to be served upon the child must waive. The only reason for that is to obviate what we feel to be the useless act of serving a summons formally on a child of the age of 12, so obviously is not competent by any standard that the law would apply to appear on its own behalf, creating the rights for doing the other things. Ridiculous to see a summons on a 6-month baby. I don't think there's any question anybody's mind on that. We simply arbitrarily felt the 12 years of the reasonable cutoff. This also reflects the cutoff that the legislature previously made on commitment to state institutions and training schools. It's simply to eliminate the possible act that you deal with. The bulk of the rest of the changes simply reflect the further sections which deal with the referee, and really the result of the fact that our referee provision is rather vague, and our attempt to make more specific functions of the referee to do the court, and to enlarge the limited extent of his authority. The needs of this became apparent to us in Lane County. We went to a referee system, which we now have. And a number of uncertainties made themselves quickly apparent. In essence, what this bill does is two things as far as the referee is concerned, the substantive nature. It provides that instead of 3 days for a person who's had a matter incurred and determined by a referee, extended to 10 days, a period within which a notice can be given and a rehearing requested. The other 3 days really isn't that. On any basis of fairness, after they receive it, it's just too short a period of time to allow the parent, the kid, the attorney, whatever it is, to give actual consideration. The second aspect of it, and it's related to the extended period, is to allow the order, to allow the referee to actually enter an order subject to the right of review, as distinguished from simply having to make findings and recommendations, which then transmitted to a judge, and the judge signs an order approving them in the event that within the 3-day period somebody has not asked to have the matter reviewed. We think that's a waste of everybody's time and effort required to be done in that manner. Statute now done. Basically, because it's a reasonable rule, I'm sure you're all aware, is only in a final order is appealable. And therefore, this gets an order in. When the order is there, it's on the record. The attorney or the party know what they're going to be appealing from. After the 10-day period is expired, and unless it's going to be here, it comes in. then the act procedure. Under the present procedure, the judge could sit on a recommendation for 60 or 90 days if he wanted on the present part of the statute. We wouldn't have to decide. This would make it automatic, and the parties would move, and a child would not be held in limbo. The present law makes it possible. This would limit the length of time to keep a child up. Sitting at the party, whoever might be before you actually make this. The others, I think, are simply a reflection of what the statute already provides, namely, that the judges and juvenile courts may assign certain specific areas of responsibility and limit those areas to referees. If you know my mom and I did about this for a long while, they have a referee system that matters. I guess since this bill went into effect, or since the juvenile court went into effect, and other courts make certain limitations to the type of proceedings. Other than that, really, I'm glad to answer any questions. If you have a question that covers the essential elements of the change in questions, Judge Ford.
Thank you. I would send you Brown, if you want to add to
it. I have nothing to add.
There's really nothing of earth-shaking nature here.
No, there isn't.
Do you want to add on it?
Well, Chairman, I hold it up.
Any discussion? Call the roll.
Maybe while she's here, we can get it solved and get it back out. The problem that arose, we passed that unanimously. The question that was raised on the floor by Senator Bates was, this thing says that the child, parent, or guardian is shown to be without sufficient financial means to appoint an attorney, the court shall appoint. Bateson raised the question on the floor of whether the parent had money and the child didn't. Should the parent be required to make that payment rather than the public? I've just chatted with Representative Brown about it now, and I'm wondering, I think we might be able to pass this the way it sits, or we might want to revise this thing. Right? She's very anxious for Bill, and I hope we might just take a minute. And,
well, if you don't think that the parent had that fund, the child, somebody else in the station provided the funding for the attorney to the child. I don't, it just seems wrong to me.
No, I think the parent should pay in that situation.
How do you suggest the amendment?
There's more than one possibility. Let me talk about a possibility and have somebody who knows more about it than me discuss it. The child now has a constitutional right to counsel. So that's clear. And if the parent won't hire him counsel, he's still got a constitutional right to counsel. That's clear. The suggestion I would make, which might not satisfy on the floor, would be to give the state or the county a right to proceed against the parent, as on the case of other necessaries furnished for a child. Now, that doesn't—that's the least that we should do. The next step from that would be to require the parent to hire one, but I don't know how you can force him if he won't do it.
You can force the parent to support the child.
Well, but that's exactly what I'm talking about here. The way you do that is have a proceeding brought by the state in the name of the state. He doesn't owe the money to the state. He owes the money to the child. But the proceeding is in the name of the state.
How about language like this? At the end of this, the court may
put an
shown to require the parents to reimburse his name or any attorney's fees paid on behalf of the child. Don't you understand?
Yeah, I wonder if it wouldn't be a little bit better. This isn't the, I have no pride in this language. This part. First, provide that the child will be entitled to the services of counsel paid for by the state. If the child is without funds, and if the parent, even though with funds, refuses to pay for such, and then at the end, in the event that the parent does have funds and refuses to provide, then the state has a course of action along the line you suggest. Put them both in.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask, do you think this would cause a problem?
Well, the one thing observation I have to make that you think this would apply only to the situation where the child and the parent were in conflict. If they were not in conflict, for instance, the child, well, I can't think of an example, but if the parents simply felt that the child needed counsel, I would think that they would have the right to make that decision if there were no conflict between the position.
You want, Betty, do you want to work on some language and bring it to us Friday?
All right. Mr. Chairman, this can be on Friday's agenda. I'll work with her. We'll get something.
All right, fine.
Or we'll talk Senator Bates and I have a problem, one or the other.
Well, I think there's a problem there whether Senator Bates sees it or not. The parent should be, the parent either refuses or is without funds to avoid it.
Wouldn't it be
to
the parent?
Well, you'd have to have a process to do that. You have a right to the state to flag, but I don't believe you'd better give a judgment to get somebody without making it.
Well, I want to tell you while you were here, let's go to 1849. I think that's what you're here on.
The next time one of the feminine members of the House has a problem, I'll look for it.
Mr. Chairman, Committee Representative Clark, 1587.
addresses itself to the problem of indigence who don't have the necessary funds for the filing fee and service fees to institute a divorce action. And principally, all of us in practice had this come to our attention where, principally I have, where you have a situation where the husband may be residing in a different state, there are children, and the woman may be on EDC or welfare or something of some nature. And the husband calls and says, I'm coming through this state, I'm going to pick up the children, I'm going to take them with me. Presently, at that point, both the mother and the father have the absolute right to custody of the children, and the court order entered before he was custody. And there's really nothing to prevent the father from taking the children and leaving the state between the jurisdiction of the court, unless there's some type of court order. The people in Multnomah County, and that's really all I testified to the Multnomah Committee, we have indicated this is what we're dealing with throughout. Welfare will not advance any funds for the filing of the divorce action. If the woman, of course, doesn't have funds to file a divorce action, she doesn't have funds to retain an attorney, but generally she referred to legal aid in Multnomah County, and legal aid tells her that she must have $75 in advance before they will undertake to represent her on the case. It puts an individual who is without any funds in the position of one, the type of circumstance that I mentioned, perhaps having the child taken from the jurisdiction of the court without any recourse. Two, a more basic question, although probably not as pressing as that situation, is that denying access to the courts for the purposes of terminating a marriage to people who don't have these funds. There is presently pending this, I believe it's the Supreme Court, a case ruling that that is unconstitutional, but deny it is a divorce case. Rationale is it may be federal Supreme Court, but I think it's
an equal protection question.
That's right. The denial of access to court based upon the inability to make a filing.
It's been established in criminal cases quite clearly, Griffin versus Alabama and other cases.
I can't deny it. And this bill, we amended it in committee, like this, that initially the bill provides that the person under those circumstances can apply in an application to court, submitting necessary information that they are in fact indigent, and then the court may then issue an order not paying any fee, temporarily waiving the prepayment or payment of the filing fee and service costs at that time. Subsequently, when the case proceeds to court, and remote the amendment provides that the court then at any time may assess those costs against either party, either the woman or the man, and they may enter such a judgment and make it free. The whole point is to get into the courtroom so that there's some disposition can be taken care of according to custody and matters like that. That's a simple bill. Directing itself to both parties. In Multnomah County, there's no way to. I know in our office, we advanced those funds on several occasions. Perhaps I have a personal interest in it. I don't mind representing them, but I hate to advance the fees in this case.
You've got to turn the table.
It's all right. No, I don't mind admitting it.
I doubt it. That's champerty.
Well, we have hopes of being repaid, but unfortunately, it hasn't occurred yet. In any event, I think it's a good bill, and probably we had no testimony in opposition to it, and the jurors of the Welfare Commission recognized that is the situation as well there.
Are there any questions?
One question. How are you going to determine what these people have done? Is there any procedure?
Affidavit. Affidavit, and a petition for a waiver of filing fees.
They'd have to satisfy the judge.
If the court finds that the party is unable,
or if you just wait that,
that's right, Bill.
1587.
Look right at the top.
Line 12.
I have a question. Why didn't you use the installment
payment route or something like that in bankruptcy.
Well, I think the, I don't know. I disagree with the bill because I've known the situation that occurred in this situation. I presume the court could require that.
Couldn't at last.
Under the last one, any time that's outside of my question. I think most judges would, in any lighting hearing, I presume they would order within a certain period of time. Thank you so much.
The word subsequently in that last amendment seems to infer that there's some subsequent time when the order would be made. I don't know why it did that word subsequently. The amendment says nothing in this section shall prevent the court having jurisdiction over the case from subsequently ordering either party to pay such fees and costs. I just don't want to get to the word subsequently.
I mean, that has no pride in the judges.
And it might cause some confusion.
Well, it sounds to me like you'd have to wait and couldn't make the orders at the same time.
You have any objections, Drake?
No.
I don't either.
All right, Senator Paley moves the word subsequently be stricken. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Any further questions? What's your pleasure on the bill as amended? Senator Wilner moves as amended. 1587. Call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Paley.
Carl, we'll have to hear 1295 Friday.
That's fine. Thanks very much. Mm-hmm.
Is there someone present here on 1676?
Yes.
All right, please.
Chairman of the Maine Supreme Priest, I'm Director of the Division of Special Child Welfare Services.
Thank you, Ricky. You know,
what a day in the
night. Night watchman gets into my door all the time, takes all my peanuts. Terrible.
Chairman, share the wealth.
Go right ahead.
I feel compromised.
But it's bribery of the first water.
First time he's ever done it.
Yeah. Just thought I'd start something new.
I just don't want you...
After that reorganization.
I don't want you making friends with all the rest of the people. I thought I had you on my
way. Well, you're the only one I brought.
All right, Mr. East, you want to write it?
Yes, House Bill 1676 would amend the time limit the State Public Welfare Commission has to make the independent adoption studies from 45 days to 90 days. Specifically, this would give us more time to make a more adequate study of the child, petitioners, and references and everything else that goes into the adequate adoption study. We think we can give more and better information to the judges for their consideration of the approval of the adoption. At the present time, Mr. Chairman, we have to ask for extension of time, unfortunately, about 70% of the cases in the independent adoption studies. And this causes a lot of frustration, we think, on the part of the court, the attorneys, the petitioners, and everyone else concerned. And we think if we have more time, we can do a better job in this area.
Would this mean then that 90 days would be the rule and you still continue asking for extensions?
Not if we can help it. I would hope that if we had the 90 days, we would be able to cut down on this 70% request and really make our studies and make them more adequately for the court.
At one time, this read 60 days and cut it back.
It was 30.
30,
yeah. 30. Then they read it.
Then 45.
Did you ever raise it to 60? I don't know.
No,
I guess I'm wrong. This wasn't wrong.
I will tell you, sir, you know this keeps the people that have an adoption pending on pins and needles. Mm-hmm. They'll call you about every day, have you heard from the Welfare Commission yet? And I can't understand why you can't do it in 45 days, as good as you can do it in 70 days or 90 days.
Well, I think there are several reasons, Senator. One is
that in 70% of the petitions we receive from the attorneys, they don't even give us a name and addresses. And we ask
them. On
the identifying information.
Well, that's got to be on the blue sheet.
Yeah.
On the blue sheet, no, in Lane County.
We don't get it. Another thing is the geographical areas. Caseworkers in there, some of the smaller counties, especially, do have time, even in some of our larger. Another problem, as I see it, is our caseworkers have larger caseloads than they had 6 years ago, and this time limit was raised from 30 to 45 days, and we just aren't able to get there as rapidly as we should, nor do I think make the study as adequately as we should, with just one visit to the home, and that's about all we get right now. And in some cases, I think we should have more time to make a more adequate study for the court.
How many cases a year do you have?
This runs about 678, Mr. Chairman, 635 in 1968.
Any questions?
How many people do you have voted to make this investigation?
We only have three counties, I think it is, Multnomah, Lane, and Marion, where we have worker or workers assigned to making these independent adoption studies, and this is all they do. In the other counties, the caseworkers have to take care of this task along with their other responsibilities, which might mean foster care, agency adoptions, protective services, or anything else that's in their caseload. And this is just part of their role.
Maybe we should confine this to those three counties and leave it at 45 and all the others.
Chairman, how many times do you find out and make any recommendation against the performance of the adoption? Very many?
No.
You know, I can't recollect one in all the adoptions I've heard.
We make recommendations to this extent, Senator. There are some times that we feel there are many negative aspects to the adoption, and we try to point these out to the court. Then we have other areas where the negative aspects are such that we do not believe the adoption should even be granted, and we advise the court that we stand ready to sign a petition to have a hearing before the juvenile court.
How many do you have?
About 12 to 15 years in this category. Now, there are other areas where we think there are negative aspects to the adoption, but not to go this far in our recommendation.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
Mr. Representative Peck, the bribery girl.
How about that, Tracy?
Been a day. You know, I don't believe in dogging the Border Patrol, and I don't believe in this and that. It's been my day to be a voice in the wilderness. I hope I'm not that here.
You're not in the house, sir.
I know. Most friends. I can look around. I have seen hospitals, but you'll notice my name is on this bill, and I became interested after two experiences I had in adoptions. The first one was a very unusual case, and it concerned a baby from welfare, and they had to wait the year for the adoption of this baby. And in the meantime, the people who thought they were never going to have any children had a child. And I've learned, I'd never dreamed this before, I always thought that if you had a child afterwards, you know, you might be a little, you know, not pay a little more attention to your own child than the one by adoption, but I heard that sometimes it's just the opposite, and that the people turn on their own child, and, you know, and their eagerness to do something for the adopted child, and it was this case, and for some reason or other, it's never been explained, this new little baby landed in the emergency hospital, or in very serious condition, and then even when it went home and showed back up again with a black eye, as opposed to bumping at the door, the mother carrying it or something. And the welfare saw fit to take the other child, which was in just a short time of the year time, was going to be adopted. And they were so concerned, they finally gave the little baby back to the original baby, back to the parents, and they held up the adopted child for a little while because there's something just peculiar here, and they just couldn't find out what it was. And they finally gave the baby back to them, and I haven't heard too much about it since, but some things were disclosed by a national doctor who was here, saw the little baby in the hospital, and whatever, went to have a lot of apprehension about what that the mother or the father, someone, maybe the mother, there was something happening, she wouldn't admit up to it because this little baby was in real serious condition, and his doctor is so sure of it, some of the things that might happen to it in the future as a result of it. And this made me quite concerned, and I thought it was a real good thing if they had this year, then to, you know, with these welfare children, to wait. And then afterwards, this other case came to me, concerned a girl of Hillcrest that I had helped at one time, and she had a Negro baby out of wedlock, I should say black, and she was going to give it up for adoption and all, and then I heard from her that she decided to keep the baby. She was out of welfare, and she decided to keep the baby, and she and a young white fellow sort of fell in love, and the girl had been a prostitute over in the Alabama area, and she married this fellow, and then they finally separated. She was back with this other life, and she gave permission for her sister to adopt the baby. Her sister was married to a black fellow, and he was in the service, and on the furlough, and he went before the judge, all dolled up in his uniform and everything, advising his attorney. He made such a good impression that Judge Lewis, and she's looking into it, it's too late now, but anyway, she gave him the baby, gave them the baby. And I didn't hear of it for a while until this girl went back to her husband, and then she left him again, and he was concerned about it, and he was very much in love with her, but she'd gone on to Reno or someplace, and then she came home because she heard that her sister was playing around with another black boy, and her husband was home on the furlough, and she was going in hiding for fear of what he would do to her. And here's this little baby, so close to this situation with her mother. The sister would bring the baby for her to babysit with her before she left, and the baby would call her auntie and call the other girl mother. And I thought the other girl hadn't been in trouble, and I thought she'd married this black boy because they'd gone to school together, but I learned afterwards they hadn't. Here she's having another affair. And it looked like a real tragedy coming up. The mother had been keeping company with somebody who stayed in her house, and she was on welfare, and she finally married him. And they, in turn, this little baby, a beautiful little girl, is going from house to house.